Due to the institution, that liturgical act is to turn on the tape machine. This is the continuation in one sense of theology and peacemaking, but after the interruption of the weekend, and also we're coming at it from a very different direction. We're going to be looking at the majority's position in Christian thought on the matter. Not my own position, but the majority position. So I'm functioning as historian, or as journalist, or as descriptive servant of the history of Western thought, so that you can enter into that thought critically and responsibly. The justifiable war idea, sometimes spoken of in shorthand as the just war doctrine or the just war theory, is the majority position of Christian thinkers since the 4th century. It has the value of common sense. If you haven't thought much about war, it's the position you hold without knowing it, without thinking about it. So we could, from scratch, spend our hour pulling out of your mind these traditional ideas, because they have a common sense quality. If we would simply ask, under what circumstances would you consider it morally valid for somebody to go to war against you? Well, then you'd say, well, only if, only if, only if, and you'd set up a number. We could do it if we spend our time that way. It's been done thousands of times. We could show how commonsensical are those criteria, and we'll come back to them in a minute. So it's a commonsensical position. It is also a confessional position, not in the Roman Catholic Church, but in most Protestant churches, and specifically in the Lutheran tradition. Some of you at least have heard of the Augsburg Confession, which was not written by Martin Luther, but by his academic sidekick, just as Johnny Carson has his Ed McMahon, and Don Quixote had his Sancho Panza, and Martin Luther had his brother Philip, who in 1530 was trying to describe what this new movement believed in such a way that the emperor, the empire, would consider it as a position that could be tolerated. Christians may, without sin, occupy civil offices or serve as princes and judges, render decisions and pass sentence according to imperial and other existing laws, punish evildoers with the sword, engage in just wars, serve as soldiers, buy and sell, take required oaths, possess property, be married, etc. Engage in just wars is the way it reads in the German. In the original, which was Latin, it said fight justly. It didn't actually have the phrase just war. But that's there it is in Article 16 of the Augsburg Confession. It also goes on to say they condemn those who teach that Christian perfection requires dividing families. So Philip went on if he hadn't heard the readings from yesterday evening. So it's confessional. It's also in the Westminster Confession if you're Congregationalist or Presbyterian, or it's in the Belgian Confession if you're Dutch Reformed, or it's in 39 Articles if you're Episcopalian. So that it is the official position of the mainline Protestant denominations. Now, what does that position say? And here it will help to distinguish it from other positions and to become aware of the logic of it if we follow a kind of flow chart that I've prepared. I think there ought to be just about enough sheets here. This saves your taking notes and saves me putting it on the board. If there aren't quite enough, maybe couples could share one. And if there aren't enough at all at the back, maybe somebody from staff could across the road to get some more copies made. This is a way to clarify how we can think, or how we do think if we think about thinking. So we'll just go down the flow from the chart. You hold it sideways for the time being. That is the long dimension horizontal. And we'll just see which questions you've come first, and if you've answered one question, then what's the next question that comes, depending on your answer. I think most of this is self-evident, but stop me if at any point it isn't. I'm not talking about what I think I'm talking about the basic, normal, natural logic of people being responsible about their moral thought. So obviously the first question you ask is whether you have to think morally about war. You can either think morally about war or not think morally about war. So that's the first question. Is it a moral issue? And let's stay on the left first. Some people say no. Well, why would it not be a moral issue? And then there are three answers. And each of them is given by responsible thinkers. One answer is that there doesn't need to be an answer. That is, it's just the nature of the case that war is a non-moral operation, a non-rational operation. When it happens, it has just fallen upon us, and we don't have any questions to ask. At least the subject has no questions to ask, the citizen. Maybe the ruler does, but that would be a different flowchart. And in modern days, that position is called, you maybe should have put it in quotes, realism. That's the line that runs all the way down the left. And there are people whom I could, we could footnote if this were trying to be a scholarly exercise, who work that out intelligently. It's not an unintelligent position. Even it's not an irresponsible position if you explain why it is that one can't ask moral questions about war. The second reason is that one works out, and this can also be done philosophically, intelligently, responsibly, that the ultimate moral value in all human life is the political community, the state. And since that is the case, or the prince, if you're in the Middle Ages, and therefore there are no other questions to ask than what the prince chooses to do or what the state chooses to do. In late medieval days, this position was represented by the court philosopher, Machiavelli, and in our generation, in our century, it was represented by fascism, or in Nazism is also a form of fascism. That is a worked out, intelligent, organized, rational, even responsible philosophical position which says that you do what the government says. The government itself is the last appeal. The third reason for saying that we don't ask questions is the one that is more important in Christian history, and we find it around the edges sometimes in Martin Luther and the other Christian thinkers of his time. God has given us this ruler. And God has given to the ruler, or to government as such, or to this royal house, the authority to tell us what to do, and none of the rest of us have any moral questions. We are to do what the ruler says. The divine right of kings is the ordinary phrase for that, although in some moral traditions it means something a little different. But it can mean this. It can mean that God has placed this Kaiser, this king, in the position of authority, and that is God's mouthpiece to us in all normal circumstances, or in all circumstances. So that's the left half of the scale, and those are serious positions. That's the point I have to make, that have been represented. Obviously, the God says position has been represented by Christian theologians, and even the fascist position has been represented by some Christian theologians, and even the realist position has been represented by some Christian theologians. War is outside of the realm where we have any moral thinking to do. The other answer that we'll pay more attention to and have to work with harder is obviously to say, yes, it is a moral issue. And then again, you have the next question, well, is it then ever morally right? And some people will say, no, never. And that position we call pacifism, and you have it on the far right of the scale. Much more current is to say it may be. Not always. If it were always, you'd be back on the other side. But it may be. Well, if it may be, then somebody has to decide, and they have to decide by some means. So here's the double question. Who decides and how is it decided? If we wanted to be very careful, we'd break that down into four answers instead of two. But these are the most obvious ones. Maybe God decides using a mouthpiece, that is, somebody who speaks for God. Or maybe people decide using criteria. Well, first we'll go on the God side. Then which God and which mouthpiece? I have three samples. There would be more. In the early books of the Old Testament, we have the wars of ancient Israel in the age of Moses and Joshua. Joshua was the one who carried on the tradition in the conquest of the Promised Land, and it is Yahweh himself, the Yahweh of hosts, which means a military title, who sends his people into battle, and they know it because he tells them. It's a prophetic utterance, or it's a revelatory event through a speaker, and you know it because God tells you. In the Middle Ages, the Christians had the same thing going, because then a pope would declare this is a crusade. This crusade was a special kind of war. It wasn't one in which the enemy had rights. It wasn't one in which there were criteria to be observed. If God has sent you off to the Holy Land to destroy the infidel, then you just do it. And there are no limits. The enemy has no rights. You don't have to keep any other rules of war. God himself has made it an absolute. And lastly, I note a category that would be much broader because there would be many other cases. Any ideology can have its holy war. You can have Stalinist holy war. You can have Castrist holy war. That is, when a cause, the cause of socialism, the cause of national socialism, or any other cause, is absolutized in such a way that its enemies have no rights. And of course, to know that, you have to have a founder, you have to have a revealer figure that has given you that absolute. Well, what's left? What's left is that instead of an absolute mandate for war, like these three, and we can group them all together and call them holy war, or call them crusade. Of course, crusade is a specific Christian form of it. There's a Muslim form, etc. In addition to that, the other is that people will make decisions. God doesn't make it for them. And in order to make those decisions, they will use criteria. That is, they will ask concrete questions about specific possible wars, or within a war, about specific possible weapons or strategies, and say that's justified, that isn't. Now, those criteria, one finds up and down the tradition in different wordings. That's what we would find if we did an inductive exercise of just my asking you questions until you came up with your common sense answers. It's very striking that there is no proper official statement of those criteria. When the Augsburg Confession said it's all right to fight in just wars, it didn't say what a just war is. It assumed you knew that. It's that commonsensical in the assumption. See, if you'd have a difference of opinion on what constitutes a just war, then it wouldn't help to know that it's all right to fight one. Those criteria are different in every source that I find, unless you can see that one person is quoting from another. So this summary is not the only one. The authority waging the war must be a legitimate authority. As a bandit can't fight a just war, I can't up and fight a just war. It has to be a legitimate government. The cause must be a just cause. The ultimate goal must be peace. The motivation must not be hatred. The means must be indispensable. They must be discriminating. They must be discriminating quantitatively, that is, you don't do more damage than you have to. You don't do more damage in the war than the damage you're trying to prevent with the war, otherwise the whole thing would do more harm than good. That's sometimes called proportionality. Qualitatively, they must be discriminating, that is, you must not destroy people who don't belong in the war. You must not kill innocent people, not only civilians and the infirm in the enemy population, but of course people in third nations, neutral nations. You must also keep the rules of international war, that is, if you have signed a treaty, your nation has signed a treaty, they must respect it. It must be the last resort. It must be winnable. I read that too fast for you to take notes, precisely to give you the impression that it's a global glob of commonsensical ideas, each of which would be in need of more careful definition. But until you define it, it's commonsensically understandable. So people will use those criteria, that kind of criteria, and ask of a war, is this one justified? And then the next question, knowable, that is the way I've just been talking realistic? Can we have enough facts to know that a war is justifiable or not? Can the criteria be defined clearly enough that we can say yes or no to a given war? Well, there are a bunch of people who very seriously, and these are mostly colleagues of Barry Rasmussen and mine in the field of Christian ethics as an academic discipline, they say, well, no, not really. It's a way to talk. It's language that helps us illumine the situation. But when you really come down to crunch, you'll never know clearly enough that you can be sure that a given war is not justified. It tells you the right questions to ask, but it doesn't tell you clearly enough that you can get firm answers. So there we have a dotted line that goes over to the left, and it's another kind of realism, really. It says this justifiable war way of thinking is meaningful. It helps us get common language so that we can debate it in among the citizenry or within the government, but it won't ever really say no. That position is incidentally taken by one paragraph in the recent Lutheran Church of America draft document on peace and politics. There's one paragraph that says the criteria are firm and they can all be met, and there's another paragraph that says they don't all have to be met. Maybe it's enough just to say if you shouldn't have an atomic weapon, you can have a smaller atomic weapon, and it won't draw lines after all. That's the ambivalence that is in the tradition. Obviously, the other answers say, yes, they are knowable. You can use them. Well, then the question is about the particular war we're talking about, or the particular weapon we're talking about, are those criteria met? And if your answer is yes, then you do have a justified war. That's the third vertical line from the right. That's the clean, standard, logical case of the justified war. The other possibilities, they say, no, they aren't met. The war that's being talked about is not justified for any of the reasons I talked about. Not a justified authority, the cause isn't worthwhile, the means being used are not discriminating, etc. If the answer to that is no, then we have another question. Are we really going to refuse that war? And again, some people would say, well, we can't really. We see that it's wrong, but we have no handles. We're not used to it, we aren't prepared for it, or maybe even we shouldn't. Maybe there's an overtone of divine right of kings after all in the back of their minds, or patriotism or something else. So then you have another line running off to the left and another form of realism. But you may say, yes, we should refuse. Well, that would still call for more branches about how you refuse. Do you become a conscientious objector? Do you just write to your congressman? Do you refuse to pay your income tax? But all of that would be in under, yes, we do refuse. And that's what's called, in quotes, just war pacifism. When we come around full circle at the end of the next hour, we'll see that there is a significant parallel between those two lines on the right in the present American political scene, between just war pacifism, which says that wars may be justified, but this one wouldn't be, and principled pacifism, which says no to all war. Now, obviously, none of this flowchart is giving reasons. Reasons for saying no, reasons for saying yes. That's all presupposed. This is just a purely formal description. These are the possible positions you can take. The sloppy use of the phrase just war can be found in contemporary journalism to cover everything but the far right line, everything but pacifism. The careful use, the academically proper use of the just war phrase would distinguish among what we have here fundamentally four logical positions. You can see them in the shape they're laid out. There would be the five lines on the left, which say there is no discrimination asked for from the citizen. There are the three lines in the middle, which are all forms of the Holy War, the Crusade, which say that war is dictated by a transcendent cause, by a god or an ideology, in such a way that there are no limits. The enemy has no rights. Then the next two, either justified war when the criteria are met, or just war pacifism when the criteria are not met, those two are the just war position, classically, and which we'll be talking about for the rest of the morning. You see the logic of it. So there are basically four positions. The five on the left, the three in the middle, the next two, and the one on the right. Those are the four logical options. Those are the four things that you can logically say about a war, more, that you won't say anything. You'll just do what government says for any of five reasons. That you are called by a divine mandate into a war. That you use criteria to say yes or no, or that you just say no. Now let's stop there for clarification. Is the logic of those divisions and those four ways of reasoning clear? I'm not talking about what I believe or what you ought to believe. I'm just talking about the way moral reasoning operates, if you look at it closely. Then the bulk of what we have to do from here on is to discover how that just war position has fallen and risen through the centuries. In order to be aware that it isn't a taken for granted position that's solid and clear, but it's rather a flow, a great variety of attitudes and reactions through the centuries, and how it has had its downs and its ups. I'll sort them that way. I'll talk first about its fall and then about its rise, but that doesn't mean that it was simply a line like this. It's rather one line descending, getting less careful, and another line rising. If this is supposed to operate, if this is supposed to be a picture of how we want to think morally, the war is not always wrong, but usually wrong. Therefore, we need to discriminate. Then the question will be whether we can actually do that discriminating. And that's what rises and falls. The ability actually to use criteria to say of a war that it's justified or not. And the story starts in a place that I only found out 2 hours ago would be especially interesting for anybody else who was here 2 hours ago. It starts with a person named Ambrose, who was a famous pagan administrator in northern Italy, a powerful person, a wise and respected person as a pagan. They were short on bishops, and they thought that if this man would become a Christian, he would make a very good bishop. So he became a very good bishop in very short order, and brought into his thinking as a Christian the heritage of being a Roman philosopher, lawyer, bureaucrat, administrator. That meant that they had Roman legal rules about the use of violence. And he actually tried to apply those rules. He baptized, in other words, the current secular pagan moral wisdom of the time, and applied it concretely, specifically to his emperor. Theodosius was the emperor during the part of the time that he was bishop, and he actually committed a massacre. He had a bunch of people whom he didn't like invited into a coliseum, and then had them all killed. And Ambrose said, that's not according to the rules. Even an emperor doesn't have the right to massacre people. So he excommunicated him until Theodosius would apologize. Of course, the apologies didn't do much for the 60,000 victims. But it stated the principle that there are limits to what a government may do, and that it is the business of Christian moral thought to state those limits and to try to apply them. Now, stop me anywhere along the way, because I'm trying to fly rather rapidly over a course of history that's pretty far back for most of us. But we have to have that history behind us in order to recognize that what we think is common sense isn't so common, and maybe isn't so sensical as it seems, because it's come and gone over the years. In the Middle Ages, the acceptance of war under these limitations was, first of all, not for everybody, but only for the few people who had the right to wage war. And that was only a few princes and their knights, who were full-time professional military heroes. And they had a code of chivalry, which was a little different from the just war, but entered into it. They fought fair. It was part of their dignity to fight fair. And then they had mercenaries whom they would hire, but mercenaries were very expensive and weren't trained, and most of the princes in the Middle Ages didn't have enough money to have many mercenaries. So war was fought by relatively small numbers of people. The citizens were supposed to stay home and stay out of it. The peasants were not supposed to have weapons. They weren't supposed to enter into it. It was supposed to be fought in their pasture fields and not even damage their grain. All of the religious were to stay out, the priests, in the parishes, and the monks, and the nuns, and even lay people who were involved in penitence, who were under spiritual discipline, were all supposed to be excluded from war. So only a few people were supposed to fight. In addition, the Church of the Middle Ages had a strong institutional commitment to peacemaking. Bishops and the Pope had power at that time, moral power. So they could intervene between two princes and mediate and say, you don't have the right to fight over this question. Bring me your debate and I'll be your judge and I'll make a ruling on it. You may not fight. They also could say, even when a war was justified, that it shouldn't be fought all the time. So there was the institution called the Truce of God. And a bishop could say, people would listen, they would obey him, because he could excommunicate them. If they didn't, then they cared about that in the Middle Ages. People in the Middle Ages didn't care, did care about going to hell, and much more than modern people. So modern people can be excommunicated, it doesn't make much difference. But in the Middle Ages, they cared. So a bishop would say, don't fight during Lent, and don't fight on these saints' days, and don't fight on Sunday. And they would all obey. Of course, if they all obeyed, it came out about even. There was no advantage if both parties obeyed the rules. And there was the peace of God, which was a different kind of institution, in which a bishop or a pope would proclaim that there are certain holy places. You don't have a right to kill anybody in a churchyard or in a cemetery. You don't have a right to fight on monastery land. Of course, monasteries owned a lot of the land in those days. So there were certain places, certain people, certain times, during which peace is the rule, and even a justified war may not be fought. So the notion of justified war almost reduced war to a kind of representative fighting by a few people. But it's like David and Goliath, you know, a champion will go out for one side and a champion will go out for the other side. After David had killed Goliath, there was no question that the Philistines would go on with the war. No, they would agree that one exchange would decide the war. And very often in the Middle Ages it was like that. A few knights from this side, a few knights from that side would have their encounter, and whoever won, the war was over. They agreed that they wouldn't fight to the last drop of blood. Very different from modern times, when we have all the citizens in it, and the notion is that any cause ought to be fought through to the bitter end. Well, that place of peacemaking in the Middle Ages needs to be talked about when we start moving down through history and we discover that the impact of the Protestant Reformation on the just war mentality was to decrease enormously the ability of these ideas to exercise restraint. Because the words are the same, but their meaning is going to be different now. Now, how was it that the Protestant Reformation made the just war theory less serious, less able to exercise restraint? Well, for one thing, it did away with what the things I was just talking about. We don't want any monks and nuns, and we don't want the priests to have different morality rules than the rest of us. We don't believe in holy times and holy places, because the whole world is holy, but also everything is secular. So we don't believe bishops ought to be able to tell princes what to do, because you can't have a reformation unless princes will tell bishops what to do. That's the way the Reformation had to happen. So the authority of bishops is decreased. The notion of a special religious dimension to life is decreased by the Protestant Reformation. The idea of holy times and places is set aside. In addition to that, the Protestant Reformation is itself something to fight about. It is the duty of certain princes to be ready to go to war to defend their territory being Lutheran, or that territory being Calvinist. So that you almost get back to a new kind of holy war, because you're fighting for the gospel, you're fighting for the freedom of the church itself, or for God's own cause. So, religion is a cause of war, as it hadn't been in the Middle Ages, except the Crusades, which were against the infidel, which is another part of the world. Those weren't just wars in this sense, they were holy wars. Another way in which the Protestant Reformation made things worse was actually that it dramatized the coming of independent nations. Before then, Europe was somehow a moral unity. It was broken up into nations and into sub-nations and sub-sub-sub duchies and counties, etc. But there was a sense in which it was all Christendom in one church. All the scholars wrote the same language. People would people were pen pals from one end of Europe to another because they all studied Latin in the same way. So it was a unified moral community. And now the Reformation has begun the breaking up of it into nations, which will begin to deny the full humanity of other nations, partly because they're now in different churches, but even beyond that. The nation itself, as a smaller human community, which no longer affirms the dignity of all the other nations, all of those other people as being of equal worth, was not caused by the Protestant Reformation, but was fostered and hastened by it. So that nationalism is stronger after the Protestant Reformation than before, and that weakens the ability to be critical of your own nation's undertakings. There would be more subcategories, but this is enough to show that the Protestant Reformation makes the just war position less an instrument of criticism of your own government than it had before, although it's still hypothetically there. Even the fact that it's in the creeds probably goes in this direction. Roman Catholicism has never put the just war position in a creed. The major Protestant groups did. That meant that Roman Catholicism still had place for pacifists, and all the Franciscans continued to be pacifists, and most of the clergy were supposed to be nonviolent. In fact, if you were a student preparing for the priesthood, that was grounds for not going to war. It was even grounds for not serving on a jury which might condemn somebody to death, because that would disqualify you for the priesthood. So within Catholicism, it was never the case that the just war position is the right position for everybody. You wouldn't be a heretic as a Roman Catholic if you denied the just war tradition, and there have always been a few people who did. You are a heretic if, as a Lutheran, you justify the just war position, or as a Calvinist, because it's there in the creeds.
Which creed would you be citing that defends the just war
position? I just read it to you, Augsburg, Article 16.
Okay.
But Westminster has the same thing, the Anglican 39 articles have the same thing, and the Dutch Reformed have the same thing, in other words. It's there in all of those traditions that were the result of a Reformation which was carried through by a government. Then the next set of things that also decrease the capacity to restrain would be what the cultural historians call enlightenment, that is the age between the 17th century and the 19th century, in which people just cared less about religion, cared less about absolute moral standards, trusted more their own intelligence and their own capacity to reason things through. Very often this included being skeptical about the church having anything to say about morality, included more trust that human common sense knows what to do, and that there aren't any restraints on that from beyond. Well, we could talk more about that, but the greater modern shift is a little after the period of enlightenment, and that's the beginning of what we call total war. And that means several different things, although if I'd ask you what it means, you'd already have most of them again in your own mind as kind of commonsensical definitions. Total war means, for one thing, that everybody is a combatant. Beginning with the French Revolution, the notion is that every citizen is a soldier. There isn't anybody who can't be called up to serve. They don't call up everybody, but they could. They would have the right to. Instead of the medieval pattern that I talked about, where you only have a handful of professional knights who are duty-bound to fight fair, and then another fluctuating number of mercenaries who get paid by the task and don't care for whom they fight, now you have the citizen soldier, the phenomenon, with universal military training, the draft that can call everybody, although it usually only calls the young men, it has the right to call everybody. That means that the old idea of who is likely to be a victim because he's an enemy soldier is getting much fuzzier, and it'll get more fuzzy on other grounds. And next, there is the notion of democracy with regard to what the nation's cause is. Until the French Revolution and the American Revolution, but the French did it more radically, it was assumed by most people that the royal house was having a war. The king has a war, the dynasty is having a war, and we'd rather stay out of it, we common people. And generally they talked about government as they. So the cause, whether they got sucked in or not, if they were the subjects of this king, they would still have to fight, but they were very aware that it was in the interest of the royal house. They weren't really themselves fighting for their own cause, but they were fighting for their king. Of course, God had given them their king, so it's a great thing to have the king that is calling us to war. But it isn't our cause as a people. Beginning with the age of philosophical democracy, It's for us that we're fighting. We are the nation. So there's a much greater level of popular involvement in the cause, stirred up by demagogues and educated that way by the public schools. Everybody now identifies emotionally and morally with the cause of the nation, so that there's a new sense in which everybody on the other side is an enemy. They all hate our guts. So does that mean we have a right to kill them because they're all enemies now instead of civilians? So that borderline of who is an enemy and who is a non-combatant, who is innocent on the other side, is getting fuzzier also for that reason, the nature of democracy. War is also total in technological sense. Beginning with the age of Napoleon, you can organize people so much better. Soon come the railroads. And whereas before that it had taken weeks to march your army on foot from one side of your own country to the other side, and it will, all of the transport will have to be done at the pace of men walking. Now you have railroads, and you can get your people from one side of the country to another in a matter of days. So there's much less time for diplomacy to solve problems before the battles actually begin. Everything is speeded up. This also begins with the technology of arms. There will be long-range cannon, which can bombard targets that the cannoneers can't see, and with no defense possible. And then modern explosives, of course, which keep getting worse all the time from then on. But the technological beginning of war being total is already there in the time of the Wars of Napoleon. It isn't something that only started in our century. It started in the last century, and people were conscious of it already. There is a new, something beyond what I talked about with regard to democracy, there is a new potential for wars for causes. The American Civil War was not really a just war in the mentality of the people. It was a crusade. It was back onto the holy level for an ideology, because it wasn't being fought once it got rolling just for the maintenance of a nation, but it was fought for the liberation of slaves, something that hadn't been worked through politically, peaceably, was now going to be imposed. It was a moral cause on both sides. At least that's the way the historians started looking back at it, that it wasn't reasonably calculated on the basis of winnability, the immunity of non-combatants, and all of the other things you have to be careful about in a justifiable war. It was a righteous cause. It was God on our side. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. You know the hymnology of the war, that it's actually God acting righteously for a holy cause. You don't ask whether the people on the other side have rights. You don't ask whether it's winnable. You have to fight it anyway. Ask who has the status of non-combatant and ought to be left at peace. You burn the crops. So new causes, ideological causes, arise with enlightenment, with the age of Napoleon and modern democracy. And it's all right to stop the story in the 19th century, because from then on what we've had is only more of the same. The escalating technology has obviously gone much farther. And we became more conscious of it with the atomic threshold, the nuclear threshold. But it's really just more of what had been going on before. We became more conscious of it already in the 20s with airplanes and the awareness that it would be possible to bomb cities with explosives. That technological expansion and acceleration and the loss of time to think about last resort and use other means has continued rising, but it's something that was already there by the middle of the last century. So that by the American Civil War, the quality of war as total was being observed by anybody who was watching carefully. And we can fill in more, we can have more details of how that went. But let's just look back, and now all of those changes have decreased the ability to think responsibly and make decisions effectively, that is, to be in control of a situation, and look at a possible war as a citizen morally responsible, or look at a particular strategic or technical dimension of a war, a specific weapon, a specific way of killing people, and ask if that's justifiable. There's less and less capacity to do that through all of these reasons, of which the two main waves of change are the Protestant Reformation and the age of Napoleon with the beginning of total war. Now that would be a breathing point before we go back to those other elements which have led the tradition to be more usable. But let's stop and ask just clarity questions for now. Do you see how it is that everything that I've talked about has tended to mean that although you still have it in your creeds that you ought to be careful, you have less and less of a handle for ever telling a government that wouldn't be a justified war or that wouldn't be a justified weapon? All of these things have decreased the possibility that having that set of criteria in the back of your minds can really say no to anything. Anything clarified? Does it mean it's perfectly clear or it's perfectly obtuse? But then other things have been happening that have moved a little in the other direction. You can't weigh them against each other in terms of quantity to know whether we're gaining or losing ground, but at least there are other things beginning to be there to be counted. And I'll go back almost to where we started. In the 16th century, for the first time, some theologians would think about the just war theory long enough to write a book about it. Now that's interesting, that from Ambrose to the 16th century, over 1,000 years, this position was a commonsensical position, but nobody thought about it. In the Middle Ages, they had people thinking full time, they had libraries full of stuff, but nobody thought about being careful about moral discrimination in war. It was thought about by confessors. It's in canon law, that is, which kinds of bloodshed will suspend you from communion for what length of time. But nobody is thinking carefully about it as a political philosopher or as a moral thinker for 1,000 years. It's common sense. And common sense means things that you think about without thinking about them, that you hold to without being critical. But in the 16th century, Spain and Portugal were taking over the New World, successfully from Florida on down, with the authorization of the Pope. And this raised a new set of questions for sensitive people. There weren't many sensitive people, but there were a few, especially some Jesuits, who discovered that there were populations out there that had never been baptized, but they looked like humans. And if they were humans, then they had to have rights. Well, most of the Spanish and Portuguese said, no, they have no rights. They are savages, or even they are subhuman. They don't have souls. There were serious debates about whether the original South Americans had souls. But a few people were prodded by that to think morally about empire and say that although there may be some grounds for a superior civilization with the authorization of the Pope to take over an area in which there is no civilization to speak of, it still isn't right to massacre those people. They are still human beings who have some rights. And this was done especially by Francisco de Vitoria, a Spanish Jesuit. And a century later, a little more was done by Domingo Suarez, another Spaniard. So there, for the first time, we have people thinking academically about the rightness of war, and specifically the rightness of empire. Vitoria was in a minority, but he was intellectually clear, and he was right in terms of the tradition. So although the Ferdinand and Isabella tried to shut him up, they couldn't kill him or completely stop him from thinking and writing. So he goes down in history as the beginning of serious critical attention to what a government does from the perspective of this tradition. He didn't stop the massacres, but he put it on paper that they were wrong. And that was one step. The next step is again associated in intellectual history with one person, a Dutch diplomat named de Groot, usually Latinized, Grotius, who is taken as the father of international law. His work was in the 17th century. We now have nations, independent nations, not recognizing any other nation as their superior. So there need to be new game rules for how nations get along with each other, and for that there was created a new class of people called diplomats. And they themselves were very often cosmopolitan. They worked for a while for one country and then for another. Grotius was Dutch, but he worked for a while for Sweden and for a while for some German places and then for France, doing the expert work of just regulating the relations of sovereign nations to each other. Well, if you're going to regulate the relations of sovereign nations, you need some rules. So Grotius worked out the rules of war from the tradition, going all the way back to Cicero and Ambrose, showing that it is morally necessary to keep respecting the law, even if you go to war. For some people on our line, and he called them cynics, and they were there in the literature, once you go to war, there is no law. He says, yes, when you go to war, some laws no longer apply because you have broken down the fabric of relations between nations, but there are fundamental moral and legal requirements that still obtain. You have to fight according to the rules. You have to fight fair. And he created what we call international law as a concept. The notion that even when sovereign nations want to destroy each other, there are still rules about how they have the right to do it. Respecting treaties, fighting fair. And that, from that, of course, has developed something which, and then in the 19th century, went a large step forward at the Arnix notch. The development of treaties. By the middle of the 19th century, Europe had settled into this idea of sovereign nations, balance of power, royal houses all being decent toward each other, marrying your children off to their children, and still being sovereign and being able to fight against each other. So that through the modern wars, the British have had a royal house that was basically German ethnically. That's all right, because the way nations work is regulated. Well, they started making treaties with each other about the treatment of prisoners. The International Red Cross was created, and they worked out treaties about the immunity from attack of a hospital or an ambulance, and the ability to carry medical goods across borders in order to take care of the prisoners. Rules for the exchange of prisoners. That developed further so that there was a growing network of rules about fighting fair that developed one set of treaties at Brussels, another set of Paris, another set of Geneva. Finally, Geneva and The Hague, especially in 1899 and 1907, brought to a first culmination a whole network of rules about how to fight fair. Most of them subscribed to by the United States in forms of treaty, which means that they are the law of the land in the United States. And that's a step forward, that you actually write out what constitutes a war crime or what constitutes fighting by the rules. One step farther in this direction, Abraham Lincoln had a profound sense of morality, even though he also was somewhat ideological about defending the nation. But he knew that it was somehow the fact that the war was being fought against our own selves, our own brothers in the South, made it more unavoidable psychologically that there ought to be limits to warfare. So he gave an assignment to an immigrant German who was a refugee from Germany because of his being a Democrat after the failure of some revolutions in 1848, Francis Lieber, a lawyer. Abraham Lincoln asked him to write up a rule for how to fight fair in war. And this was drafted and promulgated in 1863 as General Orders Number 100. Now it's a military code. Those other treaties I talked about are nation-to-nation agreements. Now there is a set of regulations how soldiers must and must not fight. Other nations have something like this, but this is one of the earliest and most careful, and they still develop. So that now we have field manuals which define the rights of civilians and what is an innocent civilian who shouldn't be killed and what is a prisoner and what are the rights of prisoners. Now that doesn't mean these rules will always be kept, but they're there in a book. which is a part of the education of officers. So it's wherewithal for restraint. Doesn't mean it'll be respected, but it's there. And you can even, from then on, have a trial of an officer who breaks those rules. You remember Lieutenant Calley. It can happen. It doesn't happen often, but it can happen. So that the notion that there are limits can be applied negatively to someone who has stepped over those limits. One more notch in taking these rules seriously. One other notch could have happened. It didn't take place in the 19th century. The first Vatican Council brought together all the Roman Catholic bishops of the world in 1870. And they were going to discuss a great number of things because it was the first council like this for centuries. Then a war broke out, which involved the Vatican. So they all scurried home and didn't finish their agenda. The one thing that they got done was to agree on the doctrine of the infallibility of the Pope. And that took longer than they thought. So they didn't get to the rest of their agenda. But the rest of their agenda had included the proposal that they should declare modern war immoral on the grounds that I've been talking about, that total war is not subject to moral regulation.
What year was that, John?
1870-71. They met in 1870 and disbanded in 71. It never got acted on, but it was there in the proposals for action that would have been gotten around to. The war hadn't broken out.
What war was it?
The Franco-Prussian War, which gave the eastern end of France back to Germany and consolidated the Prussian nation, but it also reached down into Italy. And what it meant in Italy was that the Vatican State was ceased to exist as a state. And the Vatican never accepted that until 1922. So that there was no institutional base for going on having a council right then. Then we're almost up to our time, and what we can look at as rise can be symbolized especially by code words, because we're now in the time of our own memory. Three code words. Nuremberg. What does Nuremberg mean? City in southern Germany, what happened there? After the Second World War, the victorious Allies set up a special legal process, which was very careful to be very legal, that is, respect the rules of evidence, and people are innocent until proven guilty, and all of those safeguards for legality. But then they accused and tried and punished the people who were found guilty of committing war crimes. So that it was acted out as a very dramatic, visible event that even in warfare, there are things you must not do. You must refuse to commit a war crime, even if it's an order, even if you're commanded. That you were given the order may serve as mitigation, but it doesn't mean that you weren't guilty. So the notion that it is part of the war process that, at least on the losing side, the people who committed war crimes are punishable. And of course, Lieutenant Calley indicates that even on your side, if you're honest, you will do something to restrain the war criminals. Nuremberg is a symbol of the laws of war not restraining, but being valid when they're sinned against, so that you can be punished for not respecting them. The second symbol in the American experience, and this is something that the rest of the world didn't undergo in the same way, was the Vietnam experience, in which great numbers, at least tens of thousands, of American young men refused to fight or refused to go. Why? They weren't pacifists. Maybe some of them gradually became pacifist as their position was tested and deepened. But most of them were just war pacifists. They said, it wasn't wrong that my father went to fight Hitler, and it wasn't wrong that my uncle went to Korea to fight in the 50s, but this is not a good war. It doesn't meet the criteria of just cause, or it doesn't meet the criteria of discriminating in favor of saving civilian population. or it doesn't meet the requirement of a just authority because the Saigon regime is not a good government, whatever. They're almost all of the criteria that are on the list, you could argue they were not met in Vietnam. Now, these young men didn't think that through in great detail. They hadn't been taught in their catechism what those criteria were, but they felt it because they're common sense criteria, and therefore you can have a common sense answer, this isn't a just war, without having the education that you've just acquired in the last 40 minutes. But they could think morally that there's something wrong about a war that isn't for a good cause, that doesn't discriminate to save the innocent, etc. So, selective objection, as we came to call it, is a just war pacifism phenomenon. It's the just war idea working to come up with a negative answer for an individual. Now, the idea that an individual makes decisions is one that I didn't talk about along the way, but that's also a modern idea. In the Middle Ages, individuals didn't make decisions. Individuals didn't exist in the philosophical sense. You thought of yourself as a member of your tribe, your village, your clan, and you did whatever happened. Martin Luther was one of the people who started thinking about individuals, and he actually wrote that if you know that your prince is telling you to fight in an unjust war, you shouldn't. The principle of selective objection is in the writings of Martin Luther, hypothetically. But nobody ever did it. It got recorded. It was hypothetically there. If your prince tells you to fight an unjust war, you should be willing even to give your life as a resister. But of course, you probably don't know that the war is unjust. You probably don't know enough to second guess your prince. You should give the prince the benefit of the doubt unless you know for sure that it's an unjust war. But the idea of individuals refusing to go along really only broke through in the American Vietnam experience. And the third code word of modern times is, of course, Hiroshima. And that is that the quantitative destructiveness, being beyond all limits, or the qualitative inability to discriminate to save the lives of civilians, one or the other of those, of course, really both, have gone over a new threshold into a new level. Now, ever since war became total in the age of Napoleon, you couldn't completely discriminate in favor of civilians. As soon as they had guns that would shoot 12 miles, and with explosive shells, you couldn't really discriminate. But the thought still hadn't been abandoned. But once you have a nuclear weapon, you know for sure that there will be civilian victims, and you go ahead with it anyway. You know for sure that the scale of the destruction begins to be immeasurable. So that there's another set of reasons for saying no. And it's out of that, but only 25 years later, 30 years later, that there has arisen the particular form of just war pacifism that some people call nuclear pacifism, because it is the new weapons that make people very aware that it's over the brink of anything that can be advocated or justified. So in the past, well, since 1945, it was possible to think that way. Some people did, and there are books going back that far. In 1954, the World Council of Churches organized a study group of 14 people to talk about the prevention of war in an atomic age. They came up with a nuclear pacifist position, but the document was quashed and never allowed to circulate. It really only started to be widespread way of thinking in the last 5 or 6 years. The earliest church statement was the Dutch Reformed Church that's in the Netherlands in 1962, saying that an atomic war cannot be morally justified. But in the past few years, of course, the American Roman Catholic bishops have said it. The World Council of Churches just said it. Various groups in Europe have said it. That at least all-out nuclear exchange, or any major use of a nuclear weapon, setting aside the possibility of a tiny nuclear bomb on a battleship near Antarctica, would be immoral. So now we see the doctrine able to move people to say no with these three modern code words, Nuremberg, Vietnam, and Hiroshima, as symbols of what has shaken people. We still aren't sure whether they will really say no. If we were to fall into a fascist situation where conscience, objective freedoms would not be respected, then we don't know how many people would pay how much for it. But as a set of concepts, the second line from the right now is thinkable for significant numbers of people. And that is a product of the last 5 years for most people. Now that's, I'm sorry, that's historical. It had to be historical because that's where ideas come from. And it's complex. But if we hadn't covered all that ground, we wouldn't realize to what extent our thought patterns are the products of our history. And this is the evolution of the majority position, which means that now people who have said that you may properly, morally participate in some wars have to look and can look more carefully than they ever have before. But the possibility is that the next war that their nation wants them to get into, or the one they're now preparing for, or asked to be trained for, is not one of those justifiable ones. And what will you do with it? Well, this evening we'll talk more about what you would do with it if you're going to be serious. This is where the doctrine came from and how the concepts have been working thus far. We have 3 minutes before the bell.
With these four question-answer options be acknowledged by a similar group of people sitting in Germany and or England and or
no, the
France
illus-
right now? Or
the illustrations would change, and the percentages or the weights or the feelings in one direction or another would change. But anybody that studies ethics as a way of thinking can't help coming out with the same option. And basically, they're in all cultures.
The Western.
Yeah, in all Western cultures anyway. Well, they'd even be in Eastern cultures if they stop to think critically, but they don't have the same amount of wherewithal for analysis. Now, there would be some Muslims who would talk so much about the war that God commands, which would be a form of like our crusade, that they wouldn't have thought much about the possibility of an unjust war. But really, all traditions have some of it. Like, there are Muslim pacifists, there are Buddhist pacifists. So all four options are really there because it's a matter of logical analysis. It isn't a matter of just cultural peculiarity.
Have there been tribes? Is there a history recorded of people who never cared for war?
Yeah, there are a few tribes that people turn up in New Guinea that always had enough food and never had enough energy to develop a culture of war. And there are anthropology texts talking about how some nations bring up people in such a way that violent conflict is not a part of the culture. But it's very rare, and in most nations, I mean, before modern times, in primitive tribes, most people are in the holy war category. Their divine framework and their tribal structure means that the next people in the next tribe are not really human. Mm-hmm. And so it's the uncritical holy war that is the category that's most represented in primitive peoples.
In the Middle East right now, is that considered holy war by those combatants?
Well, Khomeini says specifically that it's a holy war. Some of the other Arabs don't, but most of them do. Most of the revolutionary groups since the Algerian Revolution in the 1950s call themselves Mujahid. Jihad is the name of the war. And so they use holy war language in most cases. Although classical Islamic theology would say no, because for classical Islamic theology, it's only if all Islam backs a war that it can be a holy war.
Negotiated settlement, the possibility
in a holy war? No, if it's a real holy war, you can't negotiate it because it's God's enemies. They have to be wiped out. Thank you.